Today we'll be taking a closer look at the life and legacy of Baba Santokh Singh Ji, one of the most prominent, influential and controversial Sikh figures of the 20th century. Together we'll be unravelling the web of rumours and myths surrounding Baba Santokh Singh Ji with the assistance of Jasmeet Singh, a Nihang who spent time with Baba Ji and has personal insights to share. Together we will shed light on the life, politics and character of this prominent and complex figure. You may have already made your mind up, but we'll cover over 24 critical questions including Baba Ji's life, his rise to prominence and role during the 1980s and beyond, the changing nature of the relationship between Babaji and the Bindranath Taksal, the lasting impact of Babaji's life and work, rebuilding the Akal Takht, and reflecting on one of the darkest times in Sikh history. So join us today as we take another journey down the rabbit hole of history, and don't forget to stick around until the end to uncover the truth and catch a sneak peek of the next podcast episode where we cover another interesting historical topic. Before we dive into finding out about Baba Santokh Singh Ji, we always like to just get a brief introduction as to who the guest is. Obviously, first of all, who are you? Kind of where do you come from? What's your background?
Okay, so as we spoke about earlier, I'm from Scotland, and I would say my upbringing probably quite similar to a lot of people in this country that were born here, particularly those maybe in smaller towns where you've got a very tight Gurdwara community, and then sort of getting into Sikhi, I think kids camps, Kirtan programs, Renswise, weekly Gurdwara programs, that was kind of what sort of pushed me into and kept me in and around the Gursikhi space. When I was around 12, 13, I think that's when I first met Nihang Singh in the UK, and I was like, I had an appeal towards that thing then. But equally in India, my family comes from a village which is right next to Rakhba, which is where Babaji and the Singh's base, which is, you know, my dad, my granddad had been there. So there was some elements of that kind of peaked from there as well. And then I took Amrit when I was around 11 or 12, and it was probably around when I was 16, 17, when I started going to Babaji and the Singh, and then with Babaji and the Singh into the Burdada. And it was around 2007, I think, when I took Amrit from the Dal, Baba Santokh Singh's time. And I remember just before the Amrit Sanchar, sitting with another Singh, and we were like leaning on a horse cart with like a loose piece of cloth over covering us from the sun, with like horses making noises, you know, people boiling big things in Sarvalo Bhatte, and just all sorts. And we're like, we could really be sitting in the 1700s here. Like, there's nothing here that's screaming 20th century. Like, everything here is like, it's like we've just gone back into a time capsule. And I think that for me, like, it felt perfect, because it's not about being stuck in the past and not in the present. It's about, as a Nihang Singh, we carry that tradition from the 1700s through the 1800s and into the modern day, so that it gives people that opportunity to interact. It gives people the opportunity to see. It gives the opportunity for those who want to get involved in practicing and upholding these traditions, which are very sacred to us, because as far as, you know, the historical records that Nihang Singhs have, the history that we have, and even if we compare this against the kind of European history that we see about the Sikhs in the 1800s, like, the authenticity of what we do is very clear. I'm not saying that just from a practitioner's perspective. I'm saying that as someone that, you know, has undertaken a lot of research in this as well. I spent a lot of time in there researching in the mid-2000s, documenting things. And it was there from that, I think, more so probably just the fact that I was very lucky to have Baba Jagendra Singh as my tutor and as my teacher, taking out time, giving me the opportunity to live with them. It all just sort of came together to where I am today. So today I do Seva under the banner of Khalsa Panth UK. And really, we try and strive towards Panthak Ekta, like oneness amongst the Sikh people, while upholding our traditions, which are, you know, really trying to maintain with authenticity some of the original traditions of the Khalsa, but making them accessible to other people. So I'm not in Scotland anymore. Unfortunately, I'm in London with my family, where I do work as well. So I wear Barnum, I work in London, I work in the finance sector, and I specialize on the intersection between cybersecurity and geopolitics. So that's my kind of career niche.
You mentioned that you first took Amrit at the age of 12, and then you took Amrit again, obviously, from the Burdadal. What was it like taking Amrit at such a young age? Because I think a lot of people listening to this, or I think a general idea is that you take Amrit later on in life, when you've kind of done your hard work and all the rest of it, and you've kind of like retired, so to speak. But what was that like, and what was your experience from that point onwards?
So I think I was 11. I was at high school. Off the back of a trip to Hujur Sahib when I was about 9, I think that's, I want to take Amrit. At 10, I took Jula, and then 11, I took Amrit. I think it was when you're at high school and you take Amrit, well, at high school is an age where people can start going down a certain direction, right? That's when people start drinking, experimenting with drugs, and so on and so forth. So I think Amrit actually provided a safety net, in that I had something to kind of guide me through it, and that was really important. I feel a lot of people put off holding Amrit, I'm not ready, or what if I can't do this, what if I can't do that. You just have to accept that you're not going to be perfect at it, right? It's something someone said to me recently was, you know, no one gets 100% an exam, but 70% is an A, 60% is a B, even 50% is a pass. And I was like, you know what? I wish I had that mindset. Then, so it's a journey. You're going to struggle with lots of different things at different times in your life. And I think Amrit gives you a very good grounding in this world in terms of personal discipline, practice, virtues, values, etc. Right, it serves as a compass in its own sort of regard.
And then obviously you said that you took Amrit in 2007, and this is just before Baba Santa Singh Ji's passing. So what were your interactions with Baba Santa Singh Ji then?
So I met Baba Santa Singh with Baba Jinder Singh, and I remember this is when I was kind of quite new, and one day I didn't know the ins and outs of Vodadal. I just said to Baba Jinder Singh, do you ever meet Baba Santa Singh? And it was like, yeah, do you want to meet him? I was like, yes, because I tried to meet Baba Santa Singh before that, but I was unsuccessful. So going with Baba, he had a lot more success. They had a very good relationship with Baba Santa Singh. Because Baba Jinder Singh effectively had the same nickname as Baba Santa Singh, Baba Jinder Singh, you know, he was quite inspired by Baba Santa Singh's nickname of getting up at 12 a.m. every day, doing your nickname, your Barnia, Gata and everything until 7 a.m. And that sort of 12 a.m. to 7 a.m. routine, Baba Jinder Singh and Baba Santa Singh, it was the exact same, eating it kind of half eight, the having the sarablo, the bake, the sort of traditions and customs of, like, for us, that's the royal house of the Khalsa, right? That's our monarch. So in a lot of ways, like, they were very similar. You're right, it's the later stages of Baba Santa Singh's life. And for me, the biggest impression that I was left from all of that was I never saw Baba Santa Singh without a mala in their hand. And you know, it was very clear at that age that they were less interested with what was going on around them and more interested in having their mala in their hand. Fair enough, if you're age 19, you've done everything that you've done in your life, that you just want to peacefully be able to do your simran at the end. That to me is the Baba Santa Singh I saw.
Again, I don't know how legitimate these claims are, and these are all alleged. I remember after Babaji's passing, there were obviously rumors that Babaji didn't meet his demise naturally, and that it was, there may have been kind of a nefarious hand involved. Like, what light could you shed on that?
Baba Santa Singh, I think for a bit of context on it, like, in our tradition is referred to and was referred to as the Panth Patshah, as Baba Jinder Singh is today. And whereas for a lot of Sikhs that sort of have their idea of sovereignty, or for a lot of Sikhs that, you know, think of Mata Ranjit Singh as the kind of Sikh emperor, like as Nahang Singhs, for us it was Akali Fula Singh. Akali Fula Singh was our Patshah, Baba Hanuman Singh was our Patshah, and that lineage of the Khalsa monarchy bestowed upon it by Guru Gobind Singh Ji, you know, for us our original sovereignty. Baba Santa Singh was the figurehead of that, but it goes a lot beyond that. You then look into, well, historically, before Sikhi came to be sort of governed and controlled by a committee, SUPC, the Buddha Dal was the head of the Akal Takht. So historically, for over 200 years, in SUPC's own writings, it's very clear that Buddha Dal were the custodians of the Akal Takht. Beyond that, they have probably close to 500 Gurdwari in India today. There's a lot at stake. And right from the 1920s, when SGPC came into play, there were efforts to replace the Jathedar of Buddhadal with someone who was more amicable and amenable to the SGPC. So this is something that's not new, it's 100 years old, right? Fast forward it to the kind of modern day and around Baba Santa Singh's time. As Baba Santa Singh got towards the end of their life, there was sort of various parties looking to, you know, ensure they got their piece of the pie after Baba Santa Singh left. So there was a lot of maneuvering going on in terms of, was he poisoned? Was he killed? Was it, you know, was his death met by unnatural ends? Like, I don't know. There's a lot of speculation. And if I'm honest, I'm not sure I believe all of the speculation. I think some of it is rumors. I think that Baba Santa Singh did get physically quite ill towards the end of their life. They did have challenges. that anyone at that age, Marlborough or not, would have from a sort of physical perspective. The one thing I did see with my own eyes towards the end of Baba Santa Singh's time was when the last Buddha Dal Jod Mela, where essentially everyone was together, Baba Sarjeet Singh, Baba Santa Singh, Baba Jigendra Singh, Baba Balbir Singh, and everyone. There was around 900 police, army, military, riot police, border security force, police personnel with riot vans, commandos. Like, there was more military police personnel at that Jod Mela than Nihang Singh's. And for example, during the Darbar Sahib, there was regiments lined up outside the Darbar Sahib, and it was very clear that there was a sense of we're here to peacefully take over, and you know, if you don't comply, you'll be killed or thrown in jail. And a lot of that happened. So it's from that that then there's been a lot of the bad blood that's maybe ran through, which is a shame, because for me, Burdada was a family. And all of these people came from that family. That family's now split up, and other people who have never served in that household, you know, essentially just engage in either gossip or he's that and he's this. And they don't know, right? Ikar kar di kahani, as we say in Punjabi. This is like a story that happens in every household. And in that way, Buddha Dal is like a family that you've just seen that sort of breakup of it post Baba Santa Singh.
What could you tell us about Babaji's early life?
So Babaji's birth name is actually Peshawara Singh. They were born in Gujranwala, which is now in Pakistan. And they came from a family whose service went back to the times of Mahaz Ranjit Singh. So his ancestors were sort of notable people who had served with distinction in the armies of Mahaz Ranjit Singh. So he was born in this kind of culture and tradition of Sikh warriorhood. And they were 7 years old, I believe, when they took Amrit from Buddha Dal. So it's possible like an elder Gorsikh from the region or a Chatjataya, someone, you know, someone's obviously introduced Baba Santa Singh and brought them into the Dal at that early age, at which point they were renamed as Baba Santa, they were renamed Santa Singh, they were given the name. So this was around, Baba, he was born, I believe, around the 1920s. So the Amrit Sanchar would have been around the 1930s. This is the time where Buddha Dal has effectively just kind of been removed from the Akal Takht. So there's modern accounts of this that give a very neo-colonialist view of it. And you know, there's a whole view of the Nihang Singhs to that and records of the Nihang Singhs, which is something to explore at another time. But effectively what happened is where the Nihang Singhs have been the custodians of the Akal Takht for 200 years, the committee now comes into power and says, we want the Nihang Singhs out. So they moved to Akali Fula Singh Bodhiji. So Baba Santa Singh's time, really, of coming into the Buddha Dal, speaks of this in his Katha, was a time of poverty. Not now when it's cool or you've got the latest Barna or the Shastra and Yudhamala, you know, where it's almost like a fashion trend. Like then it was, you're really renouncing everything and living the life of a fee, fakir, a pauper, you know, a beggar before God. It was a very different time being a Nihang Singh than maybe what we see today. Baba Santa Singh, when they spent time around Punjab, they also spent time around Hujur Sahib at different times. Now, part of this was probably down to the fact that Baba Santa Singh got the wrong side of the law on more than one occasion. So when the Nihang Singhs would do this in Punjab, or they'd be wanted for something like murder or something else, then you'd just get the train and go to Hujur Sahib, where the thinking was, no one's going to come looking for me here, right? So Baba Santa Singh he spent a lot of time in and around Hujur Sahib as well. And when he was at the Gurdwara of Mata Sahib Devaji. And I believe then Baba Mit Singh may have passed. So I'm not sure if it was the direct influence and blessings of Baba Mit Singh Ji or if it was their Gurbai, their sort of brother in faith, Baba Taram Singh Nihang Singh. It was one of them who said to Baba Santa Singh, read us. And Baba Mit Singh Ji, when they taught Gurbani, they would speak the Gurbani. The students would write it in the sand. They would memorize it and then they would do the next bit. So that's how Santhya was taught by Baba Mit Singh Ji. So you wouldn't read from a poti, you would hear the Bani and how it was spelled, you'd write it in the sand, you'd memorize it. And this is why like Gursikhs of the day used to be able to write, you know, between a few of them, Guru Granth Sahib Ji, just if they got together because of these ways of learning Santhya. So when Baba Santa Singh was told to read Rairas and that there was no poti side to read from, that's when they were given the bhajan then that just get there. Remember Mata Sahadeva and read it. Like you're not here to learn, you're here to like prepare for your life, where you know Baba Santa Singh then went on as we know to teach many, many students Gurbani.
So then between the 1930s and the 19
1970s, let's say. What is going on in Babaji's life? What is happening? What is Babaji involved in? And obviously, partition's a big thing that happens, and Babaji being from what is now modern-day Pakistan, obviously there's some travel involved somewhere. Could you just shed some light on that, please?
So when Baba Santa Singh joined the Buddha Dal and they learnt Shastra Vidya, they very quickly became distinguished as a player of Gatka and practitioner of Shastra Vidya. So they toured around India and going to different akhadi, competing there and coming forward as like a Sikh champion in those sort of national martial arts competitions. Around partition time, you know, it's a very dark time in our history. But if we kind of delve into that, one of the things we know that happened was there was a lot of ethnic cleansing where it was seen as if we can get the people of X religion out of this area, Y religion becomes the majority, which means it can get, from a drawing up a border perspective, it falls on this side or the other side. So there was a lot of that going on, and where there was violence against Sikhs, essentially Baba Santa Singh, he led a group of commando Nihang Singhs, or however you might want to call it, that were trained by Baba Gyan Singh Nihang Rabji, also known as Baba Gyan Singh Satantar. And whenever there would be sort of an increase of attacks against Sikhs, or a growth in mobs inciting violence against Sikhs, Baba Santa Singh and his group would go there and effectively, you know, we know what happened in that part of our history, right? So there was a lot of that at that time going on. And Baba Santa Singh at that time became very notorious. His name became very well known. He was seen as a ringleader. And so shortly after that time, he was imprisoned and he was kept in a sort of an ice cold room, tortured for a while as well in prison. So he served hard time during that period. But he was seen in this kind of light as a bit of, in a respectful way, a daku, as a bandit. You know, we know during Baba Santa Singh's time, it was effectively the Khalsa tradition of Lutamar, right? Now people talk about this of when they want to take other people's shastra. It's about necessity to live, where it was seen as acceptable to take from the rich and give to the poor. So where in Babaji was based around Kotkapura, which is near Moga, this is where they done a lot of seva at the Gurdwara of Guru Gobind Singh Ji there. They were notorious for essentially going out at night, robbing businessmen, and then running from there to Anandpur Sahib through the jungle. So they were very, very fit. They were really, really fit when they were in the peak of the day. And some of the dal was based at Shidi Bagh there. So Baba Santa Singh would go there. He would shape whatever he'd kind of managed to steal money-wise. He'd buy rust, you know, almonds, badam, whatever he could for the ragra. He'd buy clothes for the Singhs. So he did what he could to try and lift the Nihang Singhs out of poverty in whichever way that he could. And, you know, he became sort of very, very well respected in this regard. And then you add on to that, you know, someone who's an accomplished martial artist, someone who is an accomplished Sikh historian, someone who is an accomplished Vidwan in terms of Gurbani. And on top of that is, you know, getting up at 12 a.m. to do their Nitnem, their Simit. And then on top of that is this like Robin Hood, don't mess with this guy. You know, there's a lot of things coming together in one person.
You mentioned that Babaji is earning a reputation during these decades and is applying Sikh ethics in practice, especially with this Lutmar. How does then Babaji progress to the prominence that he then takes towards the 70s and the 80s and become the Jathedar of the Buddha? Like, how does that shift happen?
You know, if we explore even some of the early years, that when they would go to Shidi Bagh, where a lot of the Nihang Singhs were, or when they were at Mata Sahdeva's Asthan, like here Baba Santa Singh was effectively told, you will be the next, you know, you will be a Jathedar of Buddha Dal. This is your destiny. You will have the seva to do. Buddha Dal is meant to be those things that are older, right? It's meant to be the veterans, those that have served their time, those who have lived a life of penance, those who have lived a life of renunciation. Like, that's the real Buddha Dal. Like, there's a lot of hype now around Buddha Dal, Buddha Dal, Buddha Dal. Like, That's not what it is. Buddha Dal is meant to be those that are older, accomplished, have served their time. And Baba Santa Singh served those people, the Bahangams, the sadhus, the ones that, you know, lived the traditions in a way where they were separate from the world and received their blessings. Also then, yeah, there is a sort of length of service time when he joined at 7 under Baba Sahib Singh Kalatari. He learned everything that he learned. At Baba Chet Singh's time, Baba Santa Singh would be entrusted to deputize at times as well. So, you know, he was almost being put into that sort of position. And then, you know, it's not without contention. Like, as I say, the head of the Buddha for many Sikhs, and this happened, you know, at Baba Santa Singh's funeral, one of the head of the Nirmala Sampradaya came, and he said that when any head of a Sampradaya is elected, the Buddha Dal Jathedar does the Dastarbandi ceremony, but when a head of Buddha Dal is selected, then all the Sampradayas come together to do the Dastar ceremony as a token of this is our collective leader. So it's a shame that we've moved away from this tradition in recent, yes and no, yes, and like we still saw this at Babaji in Singh's time when all the Taksals, the Dasis, Nirmala Seva Panthis, etc. came out. But it kind of then gives you an indication of the status, you know, when we speak of then the wealth and property, what the Dal had accumulated and had the potential for. Like, we can see why it was contested. And also, you know, political parties as well stood up opposition leaders to Baba Santa Singh at times to try and take control of Buddha Dal. So this happened a few times during Baba Santa Singh's time. But I guess that's where your background of having a history and reputation of, you know, being quite a stern person, not immune to, you know, taking matters in your own hands when needs be, right?
You mentioned that Babaji spends time in prison. How long does Babaji actually spend behind bars?
Not long. So it could have been a matter of months. They were tortured extensively but never confessed to anything or gave anyone up. So it became kind of useless.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm holding him as a prisoner.
And then you mentioned earlier that Buddha Dal, when Babaji joins, doesn't have the wealth that it accumulates over time. How does that accumulation happen?
Jathedar Baba Saheb Singh Kalatari, he was the 11th Jathedar of Buddha Dal, and Jathedar, when Baba Santa Singh joined, he was a very educated man. He was an English speaker. He had a master's degree. He'd worked in the army. He'd worked as a patwari, a land registrar. He'd worked in the courts. He'd worked in government. So when he took command of the Buddha Dal, he basically set about opening a series of legal cases to reclaim some of the Dal's lands, to reclaim some of the Gurdwara that had been taken over, and, you know, right to going back to basically challenging for the right to wear a talwar. So for Nahang Singhs, you know, the talwar, that's your kakar. It's not a small 9-inch kirpan. It's your talwar, it's your sword. That's the distinguishing feature of a Nahang Singh. And Baba Saheb Singh Kalatari spent time in jail to ensure that Nahang Singhs got this right. And then even after that, into the time of Baba Chet Singh Ji, you know, these cases carried on. So if we look into the accounts of the 1800s and the early 1900s, we see that there were Nahang Singhs as the lead sevadars around the Takats, that the Maryada, the Takats was the Maryada that Nahang Singhs have. So one of the things that they managed to do in losing control of these was to stand their legal ground on maintaining other shrines associated to the Buddha Dal. So nearly any historic Gurdwara in Sikhi that you go to, there will more likely than not be a shrine of Buddha Dal very close by there, where they still maintain the site where Nahang Singhs would be stationed. So I think having gone through, you know, the Anglo-Sikh wars where they were nearly obliterated completely, and then the early years of colonization where they were effectively sidelined and pushed out, having Baba Saheb Singh come in, who came from then within that system, trying to be more progressive to secure their legal rights, their protections, and protect what the Panth had effectively. That's what was the sort of driving force of managing to safeguard and bring some of that back together.
When you mention Buddha Dal land, what is that in reference to?
So it belonged to the Khalsa Panth. It wouldn't have belonged to the Buddha Dal. And from that, if we look at who were the heirs to the Khalsa Panth, right? During the 1800s, even from the late 1700s, from the Misildar period, where people start to identify themselves as Misildars, as Sardars. And then, you know, by the time of Raj, living in a kind of very secularized Sikh way, the Nahang Singhs effectively safeguarded those traditions. Okay, this is the Nishan Sahib, this is the Maryada, this is the way of living given to us by Guru Gobind Singh Ji. And then retaining that clear command structure as well. So when these were all put on as the names of Khalsa Panth or Akal Sena, some of these lands were bestowed by Maharaj Ranjit Singh as well. And then also around Major Gurdwara, even at Nankana Sahib, which is now in Pakistan and other places, Hajur Sahib, there's Shoni Nahang Singha. If you go around a lot of historic Sikh Gurdwara all over India, you'll find nearby a Shoni Nahang Singha, which would be a shrine with lands attached to it, which would be where the Nahang Singh stayed.
What is Babaji doing during the 80s? And there was one question in reference to a photo of Baba Santa Singh Ji and Sant Kartar Singh Ji. But equally, is much of the controversy about what we're going to talk about essentially just a conflict between kind of politicization of the relationship between the Taksals and the Buddha Dal, or Nahangs in general, and the Duxal, because it seems like things were fine at one point.
I think it's a really good question. So let's take it that it bits. So I think first time when we engage with history, particularly when that history is political, particularly when that's war and conflict and there's some genocide and there's some insurgency and there's some state oppression, like there's a lot of things all mixed together. And to really understand that, you have to be quite discerning and mature. We grow up with stories where there's a good guy, there's a bad guy, where there's a right and wrong, there's a black and white. As we get older and more mature, we realize history isn't like that. You'll know you're a historian. We realize the world isn't like that. Our relationships aren't like that, and we evolve. But I feel sometimes when we engage in our history, we're not able to see that clarity and accept that things are unclear, because it's uncomfortable. We like stories that make sense. It's easier to have a good person or a bad person. I would say we look at the Duxal side first. So when Sanganing Gurbachan Singh Ji Khalsa Pindranwale pass away, there's essentially two groups that emerge from there. So if we look at the Duxal was started by Baba Deep Singh Ji, by Mani Singh Ji, students of Guru Gobind Singh Ji. Baba Deep Singh Ji, we know, was an Akali Nahang Singh. Baba Gurbakh Singh Ji, who succeeded them, we know, was an Akali Nahang Singh. And so the Duxal emerged from within the Panth, not from anywhere where separate. It came from those students who had learned from Guru Gobind Singh Ji. And then that lineage and tradition spreads like many branches and many leaves and many fruits coming from them as it does. So Sant Sundar Singh, who was from Pindran, became very prominent Sant in the 1900s. Sant Gurbachan Singh Pindranwale succeeds them and trains up hundreds of students in teaching Gurbani and Katha Santhya, and who has a very close relationship to Buddha Dal. So at the time of partition, Sant Gurbachan Singh Pindranwale obtained 500 Buddha Dal licenses from Baba Chet Singh to give to the Singhs in his own Jatha, so that they had the rights to carry arms. And whenever they would visit Jodhmili, Sant Gurbachan Singh Ji would also take offerings to the Buddha Dal. So when Sant Gurbachan Singh Ji passes, that lineage splits into two. One being Sant Mohan Singh Ji, an older student of Sant Gurbachan Singh, who most of the Sants at the time sided with. And then Sant Gurbachan Singh Ji's one of their sevadars, Sant Kartar Singh Ji, who was much younger than Baba Mohan Singh Ji. And Sant Kartar Singh Ji was one who was sort of more in tune with the times. I would say he was more political. He was, you know, again, there's a combination of bhakti and shakti, where he's, you know, he's got that fiery side. He's willing to say things. He's willing to challenge the government, etc. And whereas a lot of people, though, they didn't side with Sant Kartar Singh Ji. They sided with Baba Mohan Singh Ji. But Baba Santa Singh actually supported Sant Kartar Singh Pindranwale. So the picture that is seen as the Star Bandi, because at the time of Sant Kartar Singh Ji, so many of the Sikh Sampradayas had gone to Baba Mohan Singh Ji. When it came to building Mehta Chaung Duxal, which is, you know, what many of us know today is the Damdami Duxal that Sant Janel Singh had gone to lead. The Mehta Chaung Duxal, when the Nee Pathar, when the foundation stone was being done for that, that's where Baba Santa Singh Ji goes and takes the Jathedars of the Tarnadals with him, and to then kind of support Sant Kartar Singh Ji in their initiatives and efforts. They do the Dastar Bandi there. So that's the sort of founding of Mehta Chaung that Sant Janel Singh goes on to lead. And then to your point on 1978, the funeral of Bhai Fojja Singh there. So in my mind, how I look at that time period, I look at that time period as being effectively the point at which we can start to see it's becoming clear that Sikhi and the state is going, you know, that it's going down the line of armed conflict. It's post 1978 that Singhs step up, create Babar Khalsa, and say we're going to avenge the killings of these innocents, that Sant Janel Singh's direction changes somewhat. You know, it was a key moment, and it happened at Vaisakhi. And Baba Tarlok Singh Khyalewali, one of the Tarnadals, he was with Baba Santa Singh Ji at the time that they received news on Vaisakhi. And he says the next day they left Sabo Ki Talwandi to travel to Amritsar to the funeral. So, you know, Baba Santa Singh wanted to pay his respects there. He wanted to make sure, as the head of Buddha Dal, that he attended and paid his respect and had darshan of those things that were shaheeded there. So we see then, at least in the 70s, Baba Santa Singh Ji playing quite a, you know, they're very involved in what's going on.
One question just off the back of that for people listening is the establishment of Mehta Chonk, like how does that fit into what's happening? And is that just another branch of an already established Sampradaya, or like how does it fit into everything?
So it's a branch of another Sampradaya, the Taksal. It's not for me to argue over or anything. You know, people will see Taksal differently. Some people will see it as its own Sampradaya. Some people will see it as part of the Nirmala Sampradaya. Some people will see it as being part of the Pant and nothing else because of the likes of Baba Deep Singh and others having started this tradition. But Mehta Chonk then becomes one stronghold of it, and it grows to prominence very quickly. And I think, you know, this is to do the seva, the kumai of Sant Kartar Singh Ji. And in my mind, I've thought a lot about why did Baba Santa Singh Ji, why was he inclined towards supporting Sant Kartar Singh Ji? And I think if you look at the Pindran Taksal and the older Mahapurk, you know, there's a way of living that's it's very simple. It's very sort of in line with the older Nirmala Sant, Sadhu Mat, Sant Mat, and essentially a life of Tyag, Bairag, and Vidya, you know, renunciation, love and devotion for God, and understanding and studying Vidya. But Sant Kartar Singh Ji came with a bit of a different twist. He wanted everyone wearing Bluetooth Dara. He wanted everyone wearing Gatri. He wanted Sikhs to have a real strong political spirit to them and infusing that. And Baba Santa Singh is the head of the Nahang Singhs. Like, why would he not want to endorse and support that? So I think that's why Baba Santa Singh took to Sant Kartar Singh, lent his support to Sant Kartar Singh. And you know, Sant Janel Singh Ji, who would go on to succeed Sant Kartar Singh Ji, I think that's why in the early years, Baba Santa Singh also lent his support there as well.
Who is Sant Kartar Singh Ji Pindranwale? Because I think for a lot of people listening, when they hear Pindranwale, they will obviously think of Sant Janel Singh Ji. But you obviously mentioned that Sant Janel Singh Ji takes his gaddi after him. But what is their relationship before that? And like, what is Sant Janel Singh Ji's involvement with Sant Kartar Singh Ji? And how do they then all connect with Baba Santa Singh Ji before the 80s?
So Sant Kartar Singh Ji was, as I mentioned, they were a sevadar of Sant Gurbachan Singh Pindranwale. When they took head of the Taksal, they were also the father of Sheed Bhai Amrik Singh Ji, who was the leader of the All Sikh India Students Federation. If you look at what Sant Janel Singh Ji did, to me, I look at Sant Kartar Singh Ji effectively doing a lot of the building blocks around that, the way that they tried to bring about a sort of awakened consciousness in Sikhs and awareness of the political situation. If we look at how he, you know, there's a famous time when Indira Gandhi came and everyone stood up and he's like, who's she? She's just the daughter of some Brahmin that's come here and we're meant to stand and give her respect in the court of Guru. You know, he was very dismissive of it, and not to be disrespectful of anyone, but it talked to his pride as a Gursikh and belief in Guru Granth Sahib Ji is supreme and that Sikhs shouldn't be subservient to state structures. So that you can see then where Sant Janel Singh Ji gets some of their inclinations and orientation from, right? Like it's coming from Sant Kartar Singh Ji, whose knowledge of Gurbani and the Santhiya tradition is coming from Sant Gurbachan Singh Ji. So Sant Janel Singh Ji, when they succeeded that, obviously with the support that Baba Santa Singh had given to Sant Kartar Singh Ji, to the support that they'd given and laying the foundation stone for Mehta Chonk. When Sant Janel Singh Ji succeeded that, at that point, you know, for the Nahang Singhs, they're seeing the Taksal as their own, and the effect that, you know, Mehta Chonk is a place that they've helped establish. They've helped put in the person that they think will be the right person to lead it. In the early years, I think, from what I've learned from the Singhs in the Dal at the time, Baba Santa Singh took quite a liking towards Sant Janel Singh, because Sant Janel Singh wasn't afraid to get up on stage and have a dig at the SGPC, wasn't afraid to have a dig at the Akali Dal, and all these things were close to the sentiments of Baba Santa Singh. So Baba Santa Singh was like, yeah, we'll support this prachar. He can do prachar at Buddha Dal Jod Mele, at Buddha Dal Zastan. You know, I think that's where, in the early stages, there was a relationship there. And we find this even in Sant Janel Singh Ji's earlier speeches, where they refer to Baba Santa Singh with some reverence, where they say, you know, if you want to learn the Maryada for doing an Akhand Path of Dasam Granth, go and visit Baba Santa Singh. They are the authority on this. There is a Maryada for Chatka there, and Baba Santa Singh will tell you this Maryada, and Sant Ji refers to it. So we see even in Sant Ji's speeches, you know, it changes at the height of the Morja, but in the early years, they're sharing that warmth that was experienced with Baba Santa Singh.
How does that relationship deteriorate? deteriorate, or what caused the change in their that dynamic?
Really good question. And to my understanding, you know, and as much as I've been able to find out, ask some of the kind of main personalities of that time from both sides, you know, when I was kind of younger in my Sikhi journey, I spent a lot of time with Singhs from Dundee Mritsar, with some of the contemporaries of Sant Dainel Singh Ji as well. So, you know, I've tried to kind of understand the picture from these angles as well. I think one of it comes down to a difference in tactics, whereas with Sant Dainel Singh Ji taking on the Anandpur resolution and, you know, effectively taking on the Indian state, Baba Santa Singh was less concerned about taking on the Indian state. They were more concerned about liberating Sikh shrines from the SGPC, which to their mind was controlled by the government. And then to their mind, all Sikh shrines are controlled by the government, as is the Sikh governing authority. And simply gaining sovereignty autonomy over these would enable the Panth to have control of its destiny again. And it's perhaps more achievable as well. So Baba Santa Singh Ji's drive, and, you know, they're very open about this and the Katha to anyone has gone in, he didn't like the Akali Dal. He effectively perceived the Akali Dals as traitors, as charlatans, as people who used Sikhi to get to power, as people who's descended from families who were, you know, conspired with the British to kill people involved in the independence movement. And his advice to Sant Dainel Singh was to stay well clear of the Akalis. And it was a love-hate relationship, because, you know, we do find times when the Akalis would go to Baba Santa Singh for support. We find pictures of some of their leaders sitting at the feet of Baba Santa Singh. We find a time when Baba Santa Singh Ji went to Delhi when there was a state of emergency declared with the Dal, and I think it was around 40,000 Singhs they had that came with them. So, you know, they were able to command an army in their own right and challenge, you know, the government as and when they needed to. There's records of when the Haryana government tried to take over land that belonged to the Buddha Dal, and Baba Santa Singh Ji sent down a squad of his Singhs armed, threatening to blow up the bridges. You know, so as and when they needed to flex their muscle, they did. But for them, the ask of the day was liberating Sikh shrines.
Are there any instances in the lead-up where there is clear conversation or dialogue between both parties in terms of what are some of the intricacies of their relationship and their agreements and disagreements?
So from some of the eyewitnesses that I spoke to that were present in those conversations that Sant Dainel Singh Ji and Baba Santa Singh Ji had, I know the SGPC and Akali Dal was the main ground of disagreements. As the 80s went on and the situation became a lot more tense, it's when I think with Sant Dainel Singh Ji, you were either with them or you weren't. And if you weren't, you were against them, right? Sant Dainel Singh Ji was getting pushed and pushed and pushed. From the time of when the Singhs are getting shaheed, their buses are getting burnt, false cases are putting on them. And, you know, that pressure comes out in Sant Dainel Singh Ji speak. They have a pop at Baba Santa Singh. They have a pop at some of the prominent Gursikhs from that time that went on to give Shahidi. So, you know, I don't think we can really pick sides and who was right or wrong. I think as a generation that's come after that, we can just look at it and think, hey, you know what? I mean, people have disputes at the best of times at things like weddings, and they're meant to be happy, peaceful events. You bring in a time when the government's conspiring to, you know, commit a well-planned attack against you, and the steps in going up to that, people are going to have disagreements. People are going to have fallouts. You know, sadly, this is reflected on in one of the latter speeches that Sant Dainel Singh Ji gives, where they say that a lot of the Santmans in Punjab are with me, apart from Baba Santa Singh. And you know, they use somewhat derogatory tone when they say it. And, you know, it doesn't reflect massively well in our times today. But I think we have to be mature enough to realize that it was a reflection of the times. It's kind of who Santa Ji was as well. It's how they spoke. It's how they rode. And in many ways, Santa Ji probably became like a parallel figure in their own right. Whereas Baba Santa Singh Ji was this guy that people would go to for help, was this guy that would break down government emergencies, was this like Sikh leader of the Panth. Sant Dainel Singh Ji sort of through their charisma, their kumai, and the seva that they did, they also, you know, I don't know, people, maybe there's competition as well. You know, that you can only look at these things from a variety of angles and think that maybe it was this, maybe it was that.
So obviously this relationship between Sanjana Singhji and Baba Santa Singhji changes over time, but does that actually influence people on the ground? Because from all intensive purposes, I would argue it didn't. I'm just assuming. Like, what could you say about that?
I don't think it really did affect things on the ground. In my experiences of India, it didn't affect things on the ground in the way that people in the West, who then decided to identify themselves as one or the other, essentially played on that and, you know, put that particular aspect under a magnifying glass and pumped a whole load of hot air into it to push one narrative or the other. I remember going to India in the 2000s and, you know, from Murakaba, there's a Taksal there, Bhopala Taksal, which is right next to it. And the Hang Singhs go there to learn. They come to Murakaba to do seva. And it's like, oh, there's really no divide here at all. So a lot of it came in the West, and then I experienced a lot of that growing up as a Nahang Singh, where you would have hatred directed towards you because of the acts of Baba Santa Singh. Like, and a lot of it came to, for me, like, people were unable to look beyond Sikh history from 1984. And I know that's a very, 1984 is a very, very painful time. It's the last 30 years, but I think if we look at Sikh history and we want to look at the future of our Pant, we have to look at it through the lens of the last 300 years, not the last 30 years. Or even 400 years and 40 years going back to the time of Guru Nanak Dev Ji. So, like, you know, look at the role of Nahang Singhs throughout that time. And then, you know, question whether it would be such that then the Nahang Singh leader, who was the heir to all of this, was, yeah, he's the bad man. He's the one who sold out. And for Nahang Singhs, I think the difference in being a Nahang Singh into other orders in Sikhi, where there's this, like, undying loyalty to your Jathadar or your Sant or your Bhai Sahib, or even your guru in some cases. The Hang Singhs don't really have that. They all have this sense of autonomy as being their own men, being an individual in their own right. Okay, fair enough if you've, like, learned from someone, or someone's your Gurudev, or you've stayed with someone for a long time, or you're their personal sevadar, etc. Then you're going to have a sense of loyalty and service and respect. But otherwise, each the Hang Singh just kind of does what they want. They're a law unto themselves. They're like, you know, the acts don't necessarily need to be sanctioned by a jathadar or approved of by a jathadar. You know, they do something out of line and jathadar says, well, they're all jathadars. You know, that's the way Nahang Singhs are. And yeah, a lot of Nahang Singhs gave Shahidi. A lot of Nahang Singhs even today will shout Jagari and Sanjana Singhji's name. So the fact that Baba Santa Singh and Sanjana Singh might have disagreed on a few points of politics, it plays no bearing on anyone's mind unless they are looking to drive a particular agenda, which is driven by putting a wedge between two different groups.
Very beautifully put. One question then, and I think this is the crux of everything. What is Baba Santa Singhji's role during the 80s?
Good question, right? I think when we get to the 80s, we know now from a lot of the records that we have that there were some individuals, including main people in the Akali Dal, including some Mahabush, who were telling Sanjana Singh to leave the Akal Takht. So then there was disagreements between some groups as to whether Sanjana Singh should have been in the Akal Takht or elsewhere. And some people used history as a reference to this, for example, where some people will say, you know, when Guru Hargobind Sahib Ji fought their battle, they didn't fight it at Harmandir Sahib. They fought the battle out with of the city to protect the pilgrims. But then I think vice versa, if you look at the history of Sant Gurbakhsh Singh Ji, Pujangi, was head of the Shahidi Missile and Taksal. When an army came to attack Harmandir Sahib, they gave Shahidi there. So I think from a point of Sikh doctrine, like, you can go either way with it. Ultimately, what happened. And in Sikhi, we honor, revere, and respect those who show fearlessness in the face of death from an inspiration they garner from Sikhi. Like, they go down as our legends and our heroes, for better or for worse. That's who we are as a people. We honor and respect our warriors. But, you know, it was a tense time. We know there were statements being made, counter statements being made. Yeah, the state apparatus was at work driving these wedges. You know, there's a lot of articles and newspaper cuttings at the time. I would take them with a pinch of salt, because if we want to take them at face value for some of the things that Baba Santa Singh is alleged to have said, and if we apply that same metric and start taking some things at face value that the media said, something else Singhji said, like, we realize that that's not necessarily the path that's going to bring us any clarity or understanding of the situation. I think Baba Santa Singh's role to the frustration of Sanjana Singhji and the build-up to 1984 was they weren't involved. They didn't lend their direct support. they gave their advice, counsel on the best route for Sandin El Singh to take. Sandin El Singh chose otherwise, and Baba Santa Singh didn't stand with him at that time in the way that he maybe stood with his predecessor.
Why? I can assume you know what the question is going to come next, but like, why did Baba Santa Singh Ji at that point decide not to? And I guess what was Babaji's advice in terms of like, what were the suggestions and advice that was being made? Because obviously there is still some rapport and communication between both parties, but what is the reasoning behind Babaji not necessarily lending his kind of first-hand support at that point?
I don't think people came to him to support at that point in the sense of, look, you're someone who's been around for more than 50 years. You're someone who has, direct reach into central government. You're someone that has a large number of men under your command. You know, if you go to someone like that, like who Baba Santa Singh is in a very powerful position, like, if you ask Baba Santa Singh, we want to do this morja, bring your men and fight for us, is one thing. If the flip side is, we want to do a morja, what's that morja? Baba Santa Singh feels involved in that decision and think it's the right decision for the Panth, then absolutely he puts the Burdalal and everything it stands for, his life, his men's life, he puts everything into it. And he didn't. So, Sandin El Singh Ji went the direction that they did, which wasn't the direction that Baba Santa Singh Ji had advised, so Baba Santa Singh didn't support it. And then also where we find the emergence of Sikh nationalism, you know, I think as a Sikh, we have a very strong sense of freedom. We have our Versailles Rajagriha Khalsa. We have the sense of our own sense of sovereignty. You know, we fought the Mughals. We then fought the British. We fought against the Hindu government. Like, it's just somebody else comes in, we'll probably fight them as well. It's kind of who we are as a people. We want the right to self-govern. Translate that into modern politics, and then there's a lot of challenges to navigate with nationalism. So Baba Santa Singh had a very, their view of Khalsa Raj was, you know, from their understanding of Sarbloh Granth, their view of the Sikh rule in India was from the time that they'd spent traveling all around India, was from being born on the Pakistan side of India, was from, you know, having a relationship with Sikhs from all over India. It was a less Punjab-centric view. It was a more wholesome view ground in a way that wasn't aligned to Sandin El Singh's view. And it's not, we don't need to say one was right or one was the other. We can respect the different traditions that people come from and the views that they hold and the importance of each of those views. I think it would be naive if as Sikhs, we weren't able to articulate the necessity that we may have for a homeland where our rights are protected. But equally, we'd be naive to not see some of the detriments that come with nationalism. So it's like, it's grey, isn't it? Doesn't need a right, wrong, good guy, bad guy. It's just two great personalities of the time who kind of leaned in different directions. And as a result of that, at the end, things got quite tense.
No, definitely. Just continuing then with Baba Santa Singh Ji, post Operation Blue Star, what happens? What is actually going on?
Baba Santa Singh Ji, as you know, the head of Burdalal, historically has right on reconstructing Akal Takht Sahib. So just as in Ahluwalia, when you know the Afghans destroyed Akal Takht, took on the seva of building it, Kali Fula Singh Ji sat there. Baba Sahib Singh Kalatari, who Baba Santa Singh joined the Dalanda, was the Jathadar of Akal Takht by to many people's view, the legitimate one, and Baba Santa Singh was the successor of that. So from a, forget people's emotions for a minute, as hard as that is to do, purely from a historical perspective, it was Baba Santa Singh's responsibility to ensure that the Akal Takht was built. In their own katha, they speak of their reasons for doing that seva. The army was in Amritsar at the time. The army was refusing to leave until reconstruction was done. The Akalis, who walked out with their hands up, to my mind, the propaganda against Baba Santa Singh Ji is, you know, it's one of the great political plays of the Akali Dal and the SUPC. They walked out with their hands up. There's letters even indicating they were in direct contact with Indira Gandhi at the time instigating the attack. And somehow Baba Santa Singh's the enemy. And what Baba Santa Singh says in their own katha is, the army was in Amritsar if the army stayed in Amritsar, apni nasal badal jani si. They're effectively talking about where soldiers stay, soldiers start to commit rape, and you're at a point of ethnic cleansing. So Baba Santha Singh is measuring how bad is this situation going to get in Punjab, and the army being here is not going to do any good for our people. So Baba Santha Singh's priority is in getting the army out. And the Akalis had written to all the Sant Mahapurush of the time, and the SGPC had written to them saying no one's going to take on the Seva. They themselves now start to undertake Morche to regain credibility amongst the people. Although Punjab people say, Loki inan nu gaalan kaddeya, how did everyone else die but these guys walk out with their hands up? So they started to build Shahidi Jathe. And in Baba Santha Singh Ji's, all this meant was old men getting young men to die so that they can maintain political credibility. And it's not that in Sikhi we shy away from Shahidi being part of our tradition, but it's that doesn't mean we're not wise and discerning to recognize that these old men are going to be the same ones in power regardless of how many people die. And then eventually when the Akalis started this Shahidi Jatha of women, so they're now sending women to liberate the Akal Takht against the army. Like, what's going to happen at the point that gets provoked? As a leader of the Panth, Baba Santha Singh Ji was not going to allow our women to go and get shot by the army in this political stunt that the Akalis had done to liberate the Akal Takht. So when he wrote to a lot of the other Sant Mahapur saying, just get the Seva done and get the army out and then let whatever happens afterwards happen. This needs to be the priority just now. Then eventually, reluctantly, Baba Santha Singh Ji takes on that Seva. And he says this himself. He asked everyone beforehand, the Kar Seva Sant, step forward, get the Seva done. What's happened is now happened. Get the army out of Amritsar. And maybe in Baba Santha Singh Ji's mind, maybe they did think, yeah, I'll go back in. I'll get the Akal Takht done. And we'll go back to the days of where Nahang Singh drove from the Akal Takht. Maybe he did. Maybe if anyone in that position would. But ultimately, the Seva that he did, the stigma that he got from the community, the hatred that he got, he came in and he effectively announced on stage that the Akalis conspired with the government for this attack to happen. They are Tankhaye, they are apostates from the Pant. The Akalis hold their own separate rally to say Baba Santha Singh has conspired with the government. He's an apostate from the Pant. Their propaganda machinery in Punjab is more powerful. The sentiments of people are such that you've got a bad guy now who's working with the government. But effectively, what did he do? He got the Akal Takht constructed. He brought in Nahang Singh to do the Seva. You know, for years we heard rumors of, yeah, the Seva was done like this, the Seva was done like that. There's videos showing Nahang Singhs, old Nahang Singhs, doing the Seva with their hands. And then he gave the keys of the Akal Takht back to the SGPC and Akal Takht once the army was gone. So he didn't, you know, for whatever people think at that time, like, it's not an easy decision to make. And it's a decision that you make that's going to attract criticism, but it was a big decision that he made, and a decision as an elder leader of the Panth had seen a lot of different times is a decision that you can understand that he made. What was the Dal to financially gain from it? There's no evidence of any financial gain from the Dal. The Dal's lands and the Dal's sites that amount to a vast amount of wealth, that fair enough, they're controlled in a small number of hands and not well utilized, but it was ample enough that he had no reason to be financially incentivized by the government. He had nothing to gain from it politically. He didn't. He had to gain from it, you know. All he had was to lose, and he did lose, because from that point onwards, having been for much of his life a prominent figure of the Sikhs, being sidelined, pushed aside, and ostracized. But yet his decision saved countless lives.
You know, when you mentioned just a second ago about how Babaji basically curses out the Akalis for having got into bed with the government, the counter meeting that the Akalis do, is that the point at which they say Babaji was excommunicated from the Panth? Is that literally just a propaganda machine wild? Yeah.
That's it. And the propaganda picked up, you know, there's a picture of Baba Santha Singh Ji where Baba Santha Singh Ji's attendants are washing Baba Santha Singh's feet. And, you know, the story circulating around it were, look, they're washing his feet and drinking it as Amrit. No, they weren't. Babaji had just come back from doing Kar Seva at Akal Takht, gone to Akali Phula Singh Burj to rest for the day, having been in the rubble bare feet. Their feet and legs are obviously covered in debris. So his attendants are washing them. And you know, it was just, it's an example of the type of propaganda. Baba Santha Singh also, he played politics in that position. He was someone that was familiar with it. He was comfortable with it. Indira Gandhi did come into the Buddha Dal at one point. I'm not sure if it was pre or post 1984. But to Baba Santha Singh, if he would be invited to Delhi He would send his sevadar Ranjot Singh to meet with Indira Gandhi. He would never go himself. He would say, this is the pant, this is center. Center, center vich aave. If Rani itthe aave pant vich. That was his thinking, that we are supreme. And, you know, he uses that word a lot in his katha, but he lived by it, that we are supreme. If the ruler of the time wants to meet with the pant, she must come here with her head bowed. And we're not going to go there to interact with them.
A lot of people point fingers at the financing of the rebuilding. Like, where is Babaji securing the funds?
It's probably one of the areas that there isn't full clarity on. So, you know, there are different stories around this. Some people say that Baba Santa Singh Ji financed it. Some people say that it was a Sikh-owned company from another part of India that came in, who received the funds directly from the government. Other people say that certain parties, because Buddha Dal is a big organization, right? It's not small. Some people say that there were others in and around Baba Santa Singh Ji who profited from it insincerely. You know, it's the times as they were, and now we're just really left with stories around it, aren't we?
There's a lot of photos that circulate quite often about the rebuilt Akal Takht then being torn down. What is going on there? Considering Babaji rebuilt it, why was it torn down? Was it simply as straightforward as they think Babaji's a stooge, so they don't want that remaining there? Or is there more to it?
I think a lot of it just comes down to sentiments. A lot of it comes down to sentiments, where, you know, there was a sentiment that we don't want the Akal Takht built by government money. Well, when the Pathans, I think it was the Afghans, maybe that destroyed Akal Takht, and Jassa Singh Ahluwalia had them labor to fix and repair it, and you broke it, you fix it. So then, like, that was a different sentiment of the time then. So, you know, again, by that account, Indian government broke it, Indian government fix it. Kind of like, yeah, you know, but at the same time, Sikhs are a pride people. And, you know, very capable of doing it themselves as well. And, you know, rightly stuck the two fingers up in a way at the government, saying, we'll make it ourselves. However, it was a sentiment of the time, wasn't it? The Pant and some Abos of the Pant followed through with it and delivered on that as well. Was some of it politicized? Yeah, probably was. You know, it goes back to the whole, we're not going to take this from the government, we're not going to stand for this. It also goes back to some aspects of the Sikh political elite looking to build credibility for themselves. But then it also, of course, goes to the Sarbat Khalsa of 1986 and other times when actually the Sikhs do get together in hundreds of thousands and declare their sovereignty, and they declare Khalistan. There's a very strong anti-government. We want nothing to do with them. So it's like all of those things come together as well, don't they? And then it gets called Sarkar Seva instead of Ghar Seva. Like, these are plays on words. You know, ultimately and truly, right, like, I think if we're left arguing, you know, as for many years people have over these things, and then using like terms like that, and, you know, sound bites or black and whites or heroes or villains, and if we do that, we've just like immersed ourselves in conflict at the point via which we've just undergone very carefully planned state violence against us, and then we're left scrapping with each other at the end of it. Like, this seems like the wrong things have happened, you know?
What has influenced Babaji's legacy since?
I think tribalism's actually shaped it a lot, where people don't just have this, we're right, they're wrong. Then it's just an extension of our football team's better than their football team. Instead of supporting Liverpool or Manchester United, you're supporting Taksal or Burdala. I think there's a lot of that, where people have got into religion and not overcome that basic tribalism. I think that's an aspect of it. I do think, yeah, politicized, but I think it also, even that, if we dissect it a little bit, there's like colonial and pre-colonial takes to it, isn't there, of the role of Burdala pre-colonialism and the continuation of that tradition to then, you know, that doesn't exist. Sikhi started in 1920 with the SUPC, who then appointed Jahadar of the Akal Takht. And it's like, if you don't subscribe to that system, like, it's never, you know, someone's never going to be able to sell that to me. So like, that's never going to hold credibility for me. And I think a lot of people, you know, as people sort of awaken to this, I think the next generation of Sikhs was going to, you know, reject a lot of this wholesale and seeing that, hold on, we were colonized and then a committee was made to lead the Pant with people appointed by the colonialists and the conspirers, and now they still carry on running things and taking money from the Goliks and using it sometimes against the Sangat when they ask for accountability and credibility. Like, at some point, Sikhs need to wake up from this. Like, they really, really need to do. It's not about the issues that we make it about. And I think also, people weren't alive then. People pick sides. people who's gone and stayed in Bodh Dhabi, who went and asked Baba Santa Singh or any of his contemporaries. People weren't even interested in it. It was narratives people grew up with that were, you know, whoever shouts the loudest wins. So that narrative then becomes the established narrative in it. What's anyone got to gain from dissecting that? It's only to become more confused and realize that truth isn't so easy and everything you thought about life needs reevaluated, you know? It's just easy, isn't it, to see it in a certain light. But actually what we miss isn't just the history, the tradition, the parampara, the heritage, everything that Baba Santa Singh stood for. We lose the core understanding of Sikh sovereignty. That the Panth is sovereign, the Panth is autonomous, the Panth has its own monarch, that Guru Granth Sahib Ji is our living deity, so on and so forth. We lose that aspect of it. We lose then everything that Baba Santa Singh did for the Panth in terms of making Panth Prakash accessible, where, you know, they don't just print it, they do katha of it and then get it published and then recordings are available of it, where they share much of the oral history of the Panth in a way that's accessible now to future generations. They have Sarbalo Granth printed, they have Surup printed and taken to the Takht Sahibs. They have a weapons factory made, they start up a world leading skill. You know, there's many things that, and not to mention, they train hundreds of parties in Guru Granth Sahib Ji Santhya, Dasam Granth Santhya, Sarablo Granth Santhya, and ensuring that, you know, Nihang Singhs, who were probably one of the less literate of the Sampradas, have this knowledge of Gurbani and history accessible to them. Right? That was all Baba Santa Singh's gift.
We've got to the end of what has now been almost a 2-hour recording. I think I've covered everything that I wanted to ask. I just wanted to check. Is there anything that you wanted to mention or anything you want to go over?
Probably when Baba Santa Singh goes back to the Akal Takht, that's a question that comes up along that people are still going to be left with. Why did he say sorry then? It wasn't the most popular decision in Bodh Dhabi, because to a lot of people, in a way, it kind of undermines everything that the Bodh Dhabi is. It's the inheritors of the pre-colonial legacy of the Panth. They have to come into that system, which is established during colonialism. There's an aspect of it that comes across as somewhat of a farce, if I'm honest. So there's that side to it, right? But then there's the other aspects of it, which you say, where is Baba Santa Singh someone that's going to just engage and immerse themselves within a farce? No, they were a more thoughtful individual than that. And I think it does come to some of what you said, that in Sikhi, Sangat is always given the highest status. So like we see this in the lives of Elder Gursikhs, like throughout. Sometimes they do things, it's the right thing to do. Sangat disagree with it and they say, Sat Bhajan, fine, I was wrong. They did what they did. And if afterwards there's a punishment to accept for it, then they take that as well. And you know, they were given a dhamka reflective of their age. So I think there was humility. I think there's an example within that. And the other thing, whereas the Nihang Singhs, more so the Bodh Dhabi at that point, probably weren't as integrated into the mainstream of Sikhi as they are today. You know, these things have all been aided by social media, presence of the Nihang Singh at some of the prominent Sikh morche or resistance that takes place at different campsites around India. People are seeing actually what Nihang Singhs bring, no one else brings. But up until that point, I think there was there was almost like, if you're a Nihang Singh, you're on the fringe. If you're a Bodh Dhabi Nihang Singh that aligns to Baba Santa Singh, you're even more on the fringe, such that it's acceptable to direct hatred towards you. So, and Baba Santa Singh Ji, kind of the steps that they took coming to the Akal Takht, to forget the politics, forget the farce, forget the SUPC, colonial, forget all of those things. And if we look at it from that perspective, it helped bring Gursikhs together and closer. So I think that was, you know, a lesson in humility and also a lesson in putting the community as a whole.
One last question then, unless there's something else that you think that is worth adding, which is, does Baba Santa Singh Ji ever reflect on what happened during the 80s in his later years of life, and especially during some of his katha, considering it's such a prominent period of our history? Like, is it ever referenced? Does Babaji ever talk about it publicly? Does he talk about it privately? And if so, what are his views, sentiments, suggestions?
There are a few examples. So for example, Baba Santa Singh didn't advocate for Khalistan in the way that we do, in the sense of a modern nation state. You know, it's not rightly or wrongly, like I say, it maybe comes from their generation, where they came from, their lived life experiences and what they thought was right at the time. But they give a vision of Khalsa Raj of the whole world. You know, that's their vision, that they say, we're still working, we're going in the direction we're going in, but they believe that the Pant is in its infancy. You know, these are times that are prophesied about in the future, and that their role was to simply keep alive those traditions. That's the sacred role of a Nahang Singh. It's good or bad, Holocaust or not, genocide or not, colonialism or not, post-colonialism, modernism, whatever ism comes, right? You hold your ground. As we are Nahang Singhs, this is where we stand. These are our traditions, and these don't bend or change for anyone. So that was a big aspect of Baba Santa Singh. You know, there's this point, and it's one of the, there's a video of it online, and I think it's from Dinsa Sala, so 1999 Vaisakhi, where Baba Santa Singh, you know, is reflecting on the Khalsa, where it's got to in 300 years, and he's telling people, you know, have faith, have belief. We're in our infancy here. We're still very young. We're in our learning stages as a community. We're still developing as a community. We have a long way to go. And if we want to aspire towards rule, then we should do so in a way that's aligned to the teachings of a guru, rather than just in the ideals propagated by politicians of today. So that's one recording. And the other one, which is probably quite significant and worth a listen, it's their own account where they talk of 1984 and what they did. And they come across really upset in that gatha, where they say, how could I betray the Pant? Like, I've been in the Pant since I was a kid. Not only is this my home, I've been given the seva and responsibility of the Nishan Sahibs of Guru Gobind Singh Ji, the original tradition, heritage, and artifacts of the Pant. Like, I'm the leader of that. How could I betray and go against that? So, you know, the emotion there is very clear. And, you know, they speak of their decision. They speak of the army and the necessity to get rid of the army. They say that, you know, when Indira Gandhi had a state of emergency, we turned up with 40,000 Nahang Singhs. And when they told us we couldn't undertake our mahalla, otherwise, you know, they would be firing in a state of emergency, Baba Santa Singh says, well, I said to them, well, look at our record and let's see yours. Because if it kicks off, we don't mind giving shahidi. We're going to heaven. Let's see how your soldiers feel about it. You know, that's who they were. And, you know, it's only people that were around them or kind of got to that sort of space that really get to see that side. And that's why they have Baba Santa Singh's posters on their walls. Because a version of Sikhi where someone's just a sant or someone's just a gyani doesn't appeal to them. If someone does those things and is quite up for it, as and when someone challenges them and wants to give it back and face them and is accustomed to using violence when they need to, then that's something of a role model that appeals to people.
I have to say thank you, not just for making the time to do this, but equally for the ability with which you've answered those questions, because I can imagine, and especially people listening, like, they come across quite pointed, and it is quite a delicate topic. It can very quickly become like a tutu meme, like, I blame you and you blame and this. And I think it's been beautiful, not just for myself, because I've learned a hell of a lot, but also for everyone listening. I think they're really going to appreciate the way that you've been able to kind of help enlighten us on this topic, especially something that is obviously very, very recent and very dear to all of us. So thank you for that.
No, thank you. And like I was saying at the start, just thanks for the opportunity to come on. I know it's a lot of hard work and it's taken us time to get here. And you know, I'll walk away now, but you'll have the work to putting this together and putting it on, you know. And I think it's important, the work that you're doing, that, you know, I hope the community carries on supporting that and enabling the work that you do and really bringing together and showcasing for the Sangha a lot more of our ancient traditions and heritage. I think that's really valuable, and you're going about it in a great way.
Thank you. It means a lot. Otherwise than that, I will leave you to what remains of your evening. I know it's taken us absolutely ages to even do this, but we've literally, I think, gone through every single bit. Thank you so much.
Thanks
for
listening.
So you've reached the end of another podcast episode, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed creating it. If you're interested in exploring more historical topics, be sure to check out our previous episodes. A special thank you to our Patreon supporters, who include Gagan Singh, Yasmin Jaswal, Amadeep Basi, Ramneek Kaur, Rav Singh, Mani Singh, Ramneek Kaur, Anish Mon, Himmat Singh Khalsa, Gurdeep Bath, Gurpreet Singh, Jas Dillon, Hernan Pazano, and Neil B. And also a special thank you to our YouTube members, Jas Dillon, N Singh, RB, Gary Parmar, GS, Gurpreet Dunjal, Radhaji Kaur, Hunter Hill, Amanveer Mandir, Homejeet Singh, and Desert Peak Films. All of you help make this work possible. If you're interested in getting involved, find the links in the description below. Otherwise than that, see you in the next podcast episode.
And, you know, there are multiple sources who independently say of each other that there was bribery, there was blackmail, there was sexual blackmail, there was all kinds of politicking, pulling in of favors.
You know, yoga in general is a bricolage, right?
There's telemarketing scams, many of them There's smuggling. There's fraudulent art sales. There's gemstone scams. There's the drug dealing, the drug smuggling. You put all that together, it's disproportionate. You know, if you had a high school where you had 20, 30, 40 people involved in felony level criminal activity, that would say something.